A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one. She's been hearing about a place called Ohalo 2, this archaeological site in Israel that keeps getting described as the earliest evidence of agriculture. She wants to know who these people actually were, what daily life looked like for them, what else was going on in the world at the time, and whether they have any connection to later civilizations in the region. And honestly, the answers upend basically everything most of us learned about how farming began.
They really do. The standard story, and I was taught this in school too, is that agriculture was invented in the Fertile Crescent around 10,000 years ago, and it was this revolutionary moment that changed everything. Ohalo 2 blows that timeline apart by 13,000 years. We're talking 23,000 years before present. That's the height of the last ice age. And these people weren't just gathering wild grains, they were actively cultivating them.
The agricultural revolution took longer than the entire span of recorded human history, just to get from the first experiment to the thing we actually call farming.
And that's the part that should change how we think about technological progress in general. But let's start with what Ohalo 2 actually is, because the discovery story itself is pretty remarkable. It's a submerged hunter-gatherer camp on the southwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was found in 1989 when a drought dropped the water level by about 3 meters. A team led by Danny Nadell from the University of Haifa got in there and started excavating, and what they found was a perfectly preserved campsite, brush huts, hearths, graves, and over 90,000 identifiable plant remains.
90,000 plant remains. That's not a typo.
Not a typo. They used a technique called wet sieving, which is basically running sediment through fine mesh with water, and it preserved botanical material that would normally disintegrate. They recovered 141 different plant species, acorns, pistachios, olives, wild grapes, and most importantly, wild cereals, emmer wheat and barley, and the grain showed clear signs of processing. They'd been dehusked, ground on basalt stones, and parched, basically toasted, to make them edible and storable.
These weren't just people snacking on whatever they found. They were processing grain at scale.
And the weed species they found mixed in with the grains are the same so-called camp, following weeds that show up at Neolithic farming sites thousands of years later. Weeds that thrive in disturbed soil, exactly the kind of soil you get when people are tilling and planting. So even back in the original 1992 and 2001 publications, the team was already arguing this looked like cultivation, but the smoking gun came just last year.
This is the 2025 PNAS paper.
Einat Sneer and colleagues at the Steinhardt Museum of Natural History in Tel Aviv. She's actually been on this for years. Her earlier work on Ohalo 2 goes back to 2015. They used a technique called phytolith morphometrics. Phytoliths are microscopic silica bodies that form inside plant cells. They're essentially plant fossils at the cellular level. Different species produce different shapes, and crucially, cultivated plants produce larger, more robust phytoliths than their wild relatives because they're growing in better conditions. Tilled soil, more water, less competition from other plants.
You can tell if a plant was tended just by looking at the shape of its microscopic silica skeletons.
And what they found was that the barley grains at Ohalo 2 were 15 to 20% larger than wild barley from the same region. That's statistically significant, and it matches the pattern you see at early Neolithic sites like Jericho, which is dated to 11,000 years before present, same signature of domestication 12,000 years earlier.
They used machine learning to do this classification.
They trained a model on known wild and domesticated phytoliths, then ran the Ohalo 2 samples through it. The model classified the grains as falling within the domesticated range. That's the technical breakthrough. We're not just eyeballing these things anymore, we've got computational confirmation.
To answer the first part of the question directly, what did these people do that was different from other hunter-gatherers? They were tilling soil, weeding, and likely watering small plots of wild cereals. They weren't farmers in the sense of planting domesticated seeds and harvesting predictable crops year after year. but they were intervening in the life cycle of plants in a deliberate way.
Archaeologists call this low-level food production. It's a middle ground between pure foraging and full-blown farming. And the key insight is that this wasn't a failed experiment that vanished. This strategy of supplementing a hunter-gatherer diet with cultivated patches persisted for over 10,000 years before the actual Neolithic agricultural revolution kicked in. That's longer than the distance between the Bronze Age and the iPhone.
Covering the covers. We keep telling the story as though someone woke up one morning and invented agriculture. But what Ohalo 2 shows is that people were messing around with cultivation for millennia before it became the dominant way of life. The revolution was a slow burn.
That reframes the whole question of why agriculture took so long to catch on. The standard explanation used to be that hunter-gatherers just hadn't figured it out yet, that they lacked the knowledge or the cognitive capacity. Ohalo 2 proves that's wrong. They knew exactly what they were doing. The knowledge was there. What they lacked was the right combination of climate conditions and genetic changes in the plants themselves to make full-time farming worth the effort.
Let's talk about the physical site itself. What did this camp actually look like?
The main structure was a brush hut, roughly 4 by 5 meters, so about the size of a small studio apartment, oval-shaped, built from tamarisk and oak branches. It had been rebuilt at least 3 times, which tells us this wasn't a one-season hunting camp. People were coming back, maintaining the structure, reinvesting in the location. Inside the hut, they found 3 distinct hearths or fire pits with fish bones and gazelle remains. Outside, there were basalt grinding stones with starch residue still embedded in the pores. And there was an open-air hearth as well, separate from the living structure.
3 hearths inside a 4-by-5-meter hut. That's a lot of fire for a small space.
It suggests the hut was being used for different activities in different zones, cooking here, tool-making there, sleeping somewhere else. And the fact that they were grinding grain on basalt mortars tells us they were processing food in ways that required significant labor investment. Basalt is heavy. These stones don't move easily. You don't lug a basalt mortar around if you're moving camp every week.
They were semi-sedentary. How many people are we talking about?
Best estimates put it at 20 to 30 people, and the evidence suggests year-round occupation. They were hunting gazelle, fallow deer, and hare. They were fishing for carp and catfish in the Sea of Galilee. The fish bones are abundant and show processing marks, and they were gathering those 141 plant species I mentioned. This was a broad-spectrum diet, not specialized big-game hunting. Which contradicts another old stereotype, the idea that Ice Age hunter-gatherers were just chasing mammoths and barely scraping by.
The last glacial maximum was at its peak around this time. What did the world actually look like?
23,000 years ago, the planet was cold. Ice sheets covered most of Canada and extended down into what's now the northern United States. In Europe, glaciers reached northern Germany and Poland. Sea levels were about 120 meters lower than today, which meant the coastline of the Levant was kilometers west of where it is now. The Bering Land Bridge between Siberia and Alaska was fully exposed. That's how humans would eventually reach the Americas, though the exact timing of that migration is still debated.
While these people were grinding barley on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, there were populations in Siberia walking across a land bridge into a completely uninhabited continent.
In Europe, people were making Venus figurines, those small carved female figures, and painting caves. Lascaux in France is dated to about 17,000 years before present, but the tradition of cave art was already old by then. Chauvet Cave is 30,000 years old. In Africa, populations were fragmented by hyper-arid conditions. The Sahara was even larger and drier than it is today. In East Asia, the Jomon culture in Japan was starting to make pottery, the oldest known pottery in the world dated to about 16,000 years before present.
Ohalo 2 isn't just early agriculture. It's part of a broader pattern of human innovation happening across multiple continents during the Ice Age. Pottery in Japan, cave art in Europe, cultivation in the Levant, all while ice sheets covered half the northern hemisphere.
Here's what's striking. The Sea of Galilee at that time was actually a much larger lake than it is today. It was called Lake Lisan, the precursor to the Dead Sea as well, because during the Ice Age, the entire Jordan Rift Valley was filled with a single massive lake system. The climate in the Levant was cooler and wetter than today, which is counterintuitive. You'd think Ice Age equals dry, but the eastern Mediterranean actually got more rainfall because storm tracks shifted south.
The Galilee region was an oasis in an otherwise cold world.
And that's probably why people settled there. It was a refugium, a a place where conditions remained habitable while much of the planet was harsh. The same pattern shows up in the genetic record. When you look at ancient DNA from later populations in the Levant, you see continuity. The people didn't leave. They stayed in these refugia and adapted.
Which brings us to the continuity question. Are the people of Ohalo II connected to later civilizations in Israel?
This is where we have to be careful, because we don't have ancient DNA from Ohalo II itself. The site is waterlogged and bone preservation is poor. But we do have ADNA from the Natufians, who lived in the same region from about 15,000 to 11,500 years before present, and the Natufian genomes tell a clear story. A 2018 study by Lazaridis and colleagues, this was published in Nature, showed that Natufians derive about 50% of their ancestry from a population they called Basal Eurasian. This is a lineage that split from all other non-African populations before 50,000 years ago, and it's most strongly represented in the ancient Near East.
The Natufians were carrying the genetic signature of a population that had been in the Levant for tens of thousands of years.
And the lithic technology, the stone tools, at Ohalo II are directly ancestral to the Natufian toolkit. We're talking about microlithic bladelets, small geometric shapes that were hafted onto wooden handles to make composite tools. The same tradition, same manufacturing techniques, same raw material sources. When you see that kind of continuity in tool making across 12,000 years, it's hard to argue that the population was replaced.
The people of Ohalo II were almost certainly the biological and cultural ancestors of the Natufians, who in turn were the ancestors of the first Neolithic farmers.
That's the consensus. The Natufians are often described as the first sedentary society. They built stone houses, they buried their dead with elaborate grave goods, they made sickles with flint blades that show the distinctive sheen of having been used to harvest cereals. But they don't show clear evidence of cultivation. They were harvesting wild stands intensively, but not planting. Ohalo II pushes intentional plant management back 8,000 years before the Natufians.
Which creates a puzzle. If people at Ohalo II were cultivating barley at 23,000 years ago, and the Natufians at 15,000 years ago were harvesting wild stands but not planting, and then the first real farming villages at Jericho and Netif Haddad don't show up until 11,500 years ago, what happened in between?
The 12,000-year gap. This is the most fascinating part of the whole story. Between Ohalo II and the pre-pottery Neolithic A, there's basically no archaeological evidence of cultivation anywhere in the world. It's a black hole.
Either the knowledge was lost, or it persisted in a form we can't detect archaeologically.
Or the climate made it impossible to practice at scale. The key event here is the Younger Dryas, a sudden cold snap that hit the northern hemisphere between 12,900 and 11,700 years before present. Temperatures in the Levant dropped by several degrees in a matter of decades. Rainfall became erratic. The wild cereal stands that people depended on would have become much less reliable.
Just when people might have been ready to scale up cultivation, the climate yanked the rug out from under them.
And when the Younger Dryas ended, the climate stabilized into the warm, wet Holocene we've been living in ever since. That's when agriculture exploded, not just in the Levant, but independently in China, in New Guinea, in the Americas. The conditions finally aligned. The plants had undergone enough genetic changes through unconscious selection, people harvesting the seeds that didn't shatter, planting the ones that germinated reliably, that they were worth investing in full time.
That's the process where you're not deliberately breeding plants, but your harvesting choices change the gene pool anyway.
Wild barley has a brittle rachis, the stem that holds the grain, which shatters when ripe, scattering the seeds. That's great for the plant, terrible for the harvester. But occasionally, a mutation produces a non-shattering rachis. If you're harvesting with a sickle, you're more likely to collect seeds from non-shattering plants, because the shattered ones are already on the ground. Over generations, you're unintentionally selecting for the trait that makes farming possible. At Ohalo II, the grains are larger, but they still show the wild-type brittle rachis. The full domestication syndrome, larger seeds, non-shattering rachis, uniform germination, hadn't evolved yet.
Ohalo II captures a moment when people were intervening in plant life cycles, but the plants themselves hadn't yet become domesticated.
It's the very beginning of the process. And that process took 12,000 years. Let that sink in. From the first cultivation experiments on the shores of the Sea of Galilee to the first full farming villages at Jericho, More time passed than from the founding of Jericho to the invention of writing, the wheel, and the internet combined.
When you put it that way, calling it an agricultural revolution sounds almost absurd.
It is absurd. The term has been criticized by archaeologists for decades, but it persists because it makes for a clean story. The reality is that agriculture was invented multiple times in multiple places, and each time it took thousands of years of low-level experimentation before it became the dominant subsistence strategy. Ohalo 2 is just the earliest known example of that experimentation.
Let's zoom in on daily life. If I'm one of the 20 to 30 people living at Ohalo 2, what does my day look like?
You wake up in the brush hut, probably around dawn. The hearth is still warm from the night before. Someone rekindles it. They're using tamarisk wood, which burns hot and fast. Breakfast might be parched barley grains mixed with water into a kind of gruel, maybe with some crushed pistachios. The grinding stones are communal. There's evidence that multiple people were using them, based on the wear patterns.
Communal grinding stones. The original office kitchen.
More like the original pub. Grinding grain is labor-intensive. It takes hours to process enough for a group this size. People would have been sitting around talking while they worked. After breakfast, the group splits up. Some head out to hunt gazelle. They're using microlith-tipped spears, probably with atlatl throwers for extra range. Others go fishing on the lake with nets or traps. The fish bones show they were catching carp and catfish, which are bottom feeders you can trap in shallows.
Someone's tending the barley patch.
That's the cultivation crew. They're working small plots, probably no more than a few hundred square meters, tilling the soil with digging sticks, pulling weeds, maybe diverting water from a nearby stream. This isn't full-time farming. It's a few hours of work, a few times a week, during the growing season. The rest of the year, they're foraging. Acorns in the fall, wild grapes in the summer, olives when they're ripe.
What about the social structure? Can we infer anything about how these people organize themselves?
The burial evidence gives us some hints. There's a grave at Ohalo 2, a single adult male buried in a flexed position with no grave goods. That's typical for the period. But at later Natufian sites, you start seeing elaborate burials with shell beads and animal teeth and ochre. Something changed in how people thought about status and the afterlife between Ohalo 2 and the Natufians. Whether that reflects a change in social hierarchy or just a change in ritual practice, we don't know.
The hut was rebuilt 3 times. That implies a multi-generational connection to the site. People were born there, grew up there, and chose to rebuild rather than relocate.
That's a big deal. Hunter-gatherers are usually defined by mobility. The assumption is that they move with the seasons, following game and ripening plants. But Ohalo 2 shows that under the right conditions, a reliable water source, abundant game, productive plant stands. People would stay put. They'd invest in permanent structures. They'd develop a sense of place.
Which is the psychological foundation for everything that comes later. Villages, towns, cities, nation-states. The idea that this patch of ground is ours and we're staying.
That sense of place is what connects Ohalo 2 to later civilizations in Israel. The Natufians built the first stone villages. The pre-pottery Neolithic, a people built Jericho, with its famous tower, one of the oldest monumental structures in the world. The pre-pottery Neolithic Bee people built large agricultural towns with ritual structures and long-distance trade networks. All of this happened within 100 kilometers of Ohalo II. The cultural DNA of the region was laid down during the Ice Age.
There's a line of continuity from a brush hut on the Sea of Galilee to the city of Jericho.
When you look at the genetic data from later populations in the Levant, Bronze Age Canaanites, Iron Age Israelites, modern Samaritans, they all carry significant ancestry from that basal Eurasian population that was already in the region at the time of Ohalo II. The Samaritans in particular are one of the oldest continuous populations in the world. Their genetic history goes straight back to the ancient Levant.
Which means, and I want to be careful not to overstate this, the people grinding barley at Ohalo 2 are, in some meaningful sense, the ancestors of people living in Israel today.
They're part of the ancestral tapestry. Not the sole ancestors. There's been plenty of migration and mixing over 23,000 years, but they're in there. The genetic thread hasn't been broken. It's been woven into a larger fabric.
That's a striking thought. 23,000 years of continuity in one small region.
It's one of the reasons the Levant is such an extraordinary archaeological laboratory. People have been living there continuously since before the last ice age. The layers of occupation are stacked up like a cake. And every now and then the water level drops, or someone digs a foundation, and we get a glimpse of a world we didn't know existed.
Which raises a question that I think is worth sitting with. If Ohalo 2 was only discovered in 1989 because of a drought, how many other sites like it are still submerged? The Sea of Galilee has fluctuated dramatically over the millennia. There could be dozens of similar camps under the water.
And as climate change alters water levels in lakes worldwide, we're going to discover more of them. The race is on to document these sites before they're destroyed by erosion or development. Underwater archaeology is still a relatively young field, and the technology is improving fast. Side-scan sonar, autonomous underwater vehicles, photogrammetry, but it's expensive and time-consuming, and most submerged prehistoric sites are discovered by accident.
The fragility of the archaeological record is something we don't think about enough. We treat our knowledge of the past as though it's a solid foundation, but it's built on a handful of lucky discoveries. Ohalo 2 exists because of a drought in 1989. If the water level hadn't dropped, we'd still be teaching that agriculture started in the Neolithic.
That's the takeaway I want people to sit with. The story of human history is full of Ohalo 2s, discoveries that upend what we thought we knew. The people at Ohalo 2 weren't primitive. They were sophisticated, adaptable, and patient in a way that's almost incomprehensible to us. They experimented with cultivation for 12,000 years before it paid off. That's not failure, that's persistence on a civilizational scale.
The next time someone tells you that technological progress is accelerating, remember that the biggest innovation in human history, the one that made cities and writing and podcasts possible, took longer than everything that came after it combined.
The slowest revolution in history produced the fastest.
And if listeners want to dig deeper, the excavation reports are available through the Israel Antiquities Authority website, hadashot-ezi.org, org.il. The Ohalo 2 collection is housed at the University of Haifa Zinman Institute of Archaeology, and some of the artifacts are on display at the Hecht Museum in Haifa.
The 2025 PNAS paper by Sneer and colleagues is open access, so anyone can read it. The phytolith morphometrics methodology is explained in detail, and the supplementary materials have the full dataset. It's technical but accessible if you're willing to take your time.
Which brings us to the open question. If Ohalo 2 represents an early experiment in cultivation that didn't take, or rather took 12,000 years to take, how many other experiments are still hidden? Under the Sea of Galilee, under the Black Sea, under the Persian Gulf, which was dry land during the Ice Age. The submerged prehistory of our species is largely unexplored.
Every time we find one of these sites, it rewrites the textbooks. The next Ohalo 2 could be discovered tomorrow.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1883, the Dutch mathematician Thomas Stieltjes proved a theorem about continued fractions while serving as an astronomer at the Leiden Observatory. But the result was lost for nearly a century until a Surinamese doctoral student at Utrecht University rediscovered it in 1978 while converting between celestial coordinate systems, and realized Stieltjes had effectively solved a unit conversion problem that astronomers had been approximating for 95 years.
An astronomer solved a math problem that astronomers then forgot about for almost a century, and they were doing it the hard way the whole time.
The history of science is just a series of reminders. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got a question that's been gnawing at you, something you keep hearing about but don't fully understand, send it to prompts at myweirdprompts.com. We'll do the research so you don't have to. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu, it's something odd.
your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.